Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this program, we continue our look into the Ferguson, Missouri investigation of the August 9, 2014 shooting death of Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old black man who was shot three times in the head by now former Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. The St. Louis County, Missouri grand jury, convened by District Attorney and Prosecutor Robert McCullough, failed to return any criminal charges against Wilson. This occurred after 3 months of weekly meetings of the grand jury. All information and facts presented were gathered and organized by the prosecutor, Robert McCullough. Our guest is attorney and law professor James A. Cohen, who has tried over 100 criminal jury trials and teaches criminal law and related topics at Fordham University Law School in New York City. Professor Cohen and I review the evidence, including Wilson's spoken testimony, the written police reports, and medical reports presented to the grand jury, which is available, along with part one of this interview, on the Radio Curious website. In the second part of our visit with Professor Cohen, we continue with Officer Wilson's testimony and the forensic evidence. We examine the duties of a prosecutor before a grand jury, the potentials for conflicts of interest, and the prosecutor's ethical obligations in those circumstances. Professor Cohen asserts that had a special prosecutor been appointed to present the evidence and facts surrounding Officer Wilson's shooting of Mr. Brown, it is likely that a significantly different decision would have resulted from the grand jury's deliberation. In this program, recorded on December 5, 2014, we begin part two with Professor Cohen's comments about Officer Williams' testimony regarding why he shot Michael Brown nine times, including three shots to Mr. Brown's head.
Officer Wilson felt that he had to get out of the car and, in effect, chase after Mr. Brown for at least two reasons. One is that he Wilson, was just subjected to being beat up, not brutally, as the absence of any serious injury proves, but he had been sort of beaten by a man in the street. Whether or not the fact that the person who subjected him to the beating was black played any role, I have no way of knowing. But given everything we know about world events and events in the United States, it wouldn't surprise me. And the other reason is a notion that as law enforcement, he had the right to direct orders at Brown and others, and more important than the right to direct the orders, he had the right to have those orders obeyed. And there would be consequences for the failure to obey. And that's a problem not just for Wilson and others, but as we've heard, it seems to be a problem with law enforcement in general. Law enforcement reacts very, very negatively if their orders or directions are not followed. They react more negatively, it seems, as events have proved and will continue to prove, if the person disobeying is a black man, a young black man. And as is always the case, because these encounters infrequently, although they do sometimes happen, they infrequently involve someone who is just wandering down the street with his hands in his pocket. I shouldn't say that, because if his hands are in his pocket, he might be hiding a gun. Just wandering down the street with hands visible and not up to no good or doing anything wrong at all. A lot of people feel that Mr. Brown was engaged in some sort of robbery at this convenience store, forcible taking. In fact, I think the owners of the store and an owner of the store was sort of pushed around, although there were no weapons. It doesn't make it any less a forcible taking. And again, when Brown failed to get out of the way, Officer Wilson testified, as did others, that Brown and his apparent friend were walking down the middle of the street, and they disobeyed Wilson's orders, in effect, to get to the sidewalk. So when you disobey a police officer and you are black, the risks are much higher than if I were to disobey the directions of a police officer.
Let's move to the forensic evidence. What does that tell us?
Well, the forensic evidence, unfortunately, doesn't tell us everything. The forensic evidence does indicate that there were 9 shots fired, does indicate that 3 of those shots hit Mr. Brown in the head. I think 1 shot hit him in the hand, but there were 9 shots, which is a lot of shots fired. It does not tell us where Mr. Brown's hands were, and I mention that specifically in the context of claims by some witnesses that he had his hands up in a "I'm ready to surrender" fashion. It does not tell us whether or not Mr. Brown was in any way, quote unquote, charging the police officer at the time that he was shot. So the forensic evidence on those points is simply of no value. And that's too bad, because if it could show that Mr. Brown was in fact charging the officer, depending on some other things like distance, whether there were other officers in the area, whether the distance was such so that the officer could have shot Mr. Brown in a less likely to be fatal area of his body. It doesn't tell us how much space there was between Mr. Brown and Mr. Wilson. So the forensic evidence doesn't help us all that much on some of those key questions. I will note, though, that of the 9 shots that were fired, 3 managed to hit Mr. Brown in his head. So it suggests to me that Mr. Wilson was a pretty good shot under very difficult circumstances. Because don't forget, he had just been beaten, supposedly, by Brown, had just expressed, as he recounted it, fear for his life. And under those circumstances, he turned out to be a darn good shot.
In our earlier conversation, you pointed out that there was no cross-examination of Darren Wilson. What questions would you have asked Darren Wilson if you had that opportunity when the evidence was presented to the grand jury?
Okay, there's a whole series of questions in sections that Brown should have been asked. And this, I stress, is merely to get some clarification. It is not in an attempt to persuade the grand jurors that Mr. Wilson committed a homicide. All right? A set of questions should have been asked to both clarify and make clear on the record the story that Mr. Wilson was telling about Brown's encounter with him, Wilson, in the car. So that should have been nailed down very, very specifically, including Wilson's state of mind during this period of time. So that should have been done. And in contrast with that testimony, the forensic evidence that showed little injury to Wilson should have been contrasted with that. And that's a whole other set of questions which is designed to, in effect, compare and contrast the seriousness of the beating that Wilson said he suffered and his fear. His state of mind being in a state of fear that the next blow that Brown might administer would be fatal to Wilson. So I think you confront Wilson with the meager evidence of serious injury, and you see what his answers are to that. And then you need to sort of say, figure out, well, what's going to come of that? And I think what would come of that, or let me back up, what could come of that is Wilson, in effect, dissembling. Wilson then admitting that things were not quite as he had stated them before. All right? So that would be the object of those kinds of questions, which is to pinpoint exactly how Wilson felt and why he felt that way at particular times. Another set of questions ought to be why he got out of his car. when were backup or reinforcements called? Who called them? Did Wilson call them? I don't remember right now. How long Wilson believed that it would take for them to get there? How far away, as Wilson was sitting in the car after Brown left, was Brown? What did Wilson see on the street? And by that I mean, were there crowds there in any way, as there certainly were later? Wilson's superior, the sergeant who testified before him, testified that when he arrived, there were, I think, 10 to 15 people milling around on the street. So it would have been useful to get what Wilson saw or thought he saw. It would have been useful in that connection to find out or explore Wilson's beliefs about what he was entitled to do when someone disobeyed him. Deviating from this just for a second, there was apparently the prosecutors in this case submitted to the grand jury a statute, and they gave copies to everybody of the applicable law in terms of the officer's use of force. Turns out that the statute, and this was early on, the statute was from, I think, 1993, and it was a statute that had been specifically ruled unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court. And that statute was left with the jury for at least several days, I don't know how long, until the prosecutors came back and corrected it. And that statute said a police officer is justified in using deadly physical force on a fleeing suspect. Now, it's not the law. It wasn't the law when this case was presented. And ultimately, the prosecutors corrected that. But it tells us something. The fact that they would do that tells us something about their mindset, about how sympathetic they were to Wilson, and hostile they were to Mr. Brown's intrusion, if you will, with respect to Officer Wilson's face. Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that Brown ought to have done what he did do, apparently. I am observing that nothing that Brown did is in anything that I'm aware of punishable by the death penalty, and as you said, Barry, without any sort of process whatsoever.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting in part two with a conversation with Professor James A. Cohen from Fordham University in Manhattan, New York. And we're talking about the grand jury investigation in Ferguson, Missouri, of the death of Michael Brown, who was shot and killed by police officer Darren Wilson in August of 2014. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jim, staying with the testimony that was brought before the grand jury, we know that there was a forensic investigator employed by the state of Missouri who testified. The family hired Dr. Michael Badden, an experienced forensic investigator, to form an opinion about what happened.
Michael Badden, who used to be the medical examiner for the city of New York, and is now, if you will, in private practice, which means he does autopsies at the request of family and some law enforcement agencies, et cetera, was called into this case and did conduct an autopsy on Mr. Brown's body. Badden did not have Brown's clothes at the time, and there was some question in Badden's mind as to whether or not injuries to the body showed a close-range gunshot, which had to do with powder burns. And Badden couldn't resolve that issue unless he were able to see the clothes, because either the clothes might have absorbed powder burns or would reflect the powder burns. And Badden couldn't get access to those clothes. The significant thing about Badden's testimony is that he did not testify early on, or even in the middle of this proceeding. Badden testified at the request of a grand juror who had obviously heard about this independent autopsy, and towards the end of the proceedings asked the prosecutor whether or not the grand jury could hear that testimony. The significance of that to me was that the fact that the prosecutors hadn't called Badden earlier in a timely fashion, because it's sort of a foundation-level testimony, said to me that the prosecutors claim that they were going to present a full and fair picture of the evidence and the evidence to the grand jury was just false. That was the most significant piece of possible favorable evidence to Mr. Brown. And the prosecutors did not have that witness on their list and only put the witness on their list at the request of a grand juror and only did so towards the end of the proceedings.
For our listeners, I'd like to mention that there is an interview with Dr. Michael Badden on the Radio Curious website, radiocurious.org, that was done in 2002 about how a forensic pathologist works. Jim Cohen, let's move on to what could be done in this case using, for example, a prosecution in federal court for violation of Michael Brown's civil rights.
Yes, and although I have said that that is quite unlikely, the result in this case and the result in other cases, including the situation in Cleveland, which has been reviewed by the Department of Justice, makes it at least somewhat more likely that the Department of Justice might act in this case and in some other cases. What's becoming clear is that state grand juries in matters that involve claims or possible claims of police misconduct or excessive force can't be trusted to get it right. Now, let me amend that statement just for a second. It's really not the grand juries themselves, because the grand juries don't have any power in this situation. It's the prosecutor that has all the power. And what's becoming clearer and clearer is that the prosecutor is, to use a colloquial expression, is in bed with the police department. Indeed, the prosecutor almost has to be in bed with the police department, because the prosecutor depends on the police department to feed him work. If the police department concludes that the prosecutor is hostile or not sympathetic or not as on board with the police department as the police department would like, cooperation will become much, much more difficult. There is, in my judgment, a conflict of interest when the sitting prosecutor, if you will, the prosecutor of the county, undertakes to submit these cases to grand jurors when they involve possible misconduct by police officers. I think it's a legal conflict of interest. It's an ethical conflict of interest. The prosecutor can't have what is required by law and the law of ethics, independent judgment in these sorts of situations. Mm-hmm. And I think the reform will come because we will move away from, we will move in the direction of having independent special prosecutors handle these cases in the future.
When you say independent judgment, that should include, I believe, the advocacy from a point of view of impartiality, the impartial role of the prosecutor, which is part of the prosecutorial ethic.
Absolutely. The prosecutor is obligated by law and by role and by ethics to be impartial. And that's not something we've seen in some of these cases. The ethics rules require a lawyer to exercise independent judgment. And if the prosecutor is concerned, or it appears that the prosecutor could be concerned, that coming down too hard on a police officer in a particular situation will ruffle feathers in the police department such that it will be difficult for the prosecutor to do his or her job, that's not independent judgment. And it has to be the case that a prosecutor is affected by all these things. So I have come to believe that it is a violation of the ethical rules for the prosecutor in these cases, as we've seen, to put these cases before the grand jury when the prosecutor is potentially criticizing the police officers that work with him and for him on a daily basis.
What, in your opinion, Professor Cohen, can be done by the average person who is potentially affected by this kind of behavior on the part of a prosecutor, regardless of where it is, and regardless of the level, in a rural district or a very metropolitan district? What can the average person do to change this?
Well, that's a hard question. I think that there's a couple of things that ought to be considered, at least. I'm a big fan, perhaps because of the nature of my job, of people consulting lawyers in terms of identifying some possible problems, identifying some possible fears, and asking lawyers for advice connected to that particular situation. I think, and I'm very sad to have to say it, that black parents need to keep their sons off the street as much as possible, because it's pretty clear now that they don't seem to be safe, whether it's a rural area or an urban area. I think that as citizens, people can think about the extent to which an independent prosecutor would be a good thing in these areas, and contact their elected officials and try to get them to do something about it. They can, I think, in this context, contact the Department of Justice, which under most circumstances might not get involved in these cases. But given that the prosecutors seem not to be doing their job, that might put some pressure, and that might be an angle that the Department of Justice would pick up on. So having said it's a difficult question, I now went on to say lots of things which may not be good answers, but at least they're in the right box.
Let's talk about the sociological perspective from your point of view that causes the streets to be unsafe for young black men.
Okay, well, I have been doing criminal defense work in urban areas for longer than I care to remember. Let's just say since 1976. And the incidence of black men being the subject of arrests, of young black men actually committing crimes, but sometimes not the crime for which they were accused, sometimes much more minor crimes, and the incidence of white police officers making those arrests is shocking. Those things are not going to disappear quickly. They may never disappear. It seems to be beyond anyone's control. I don't know if you want to get into this, Barry, but I guess the Cleveland Police Department was just put in receivership by the Department of Justice. They have to now agree on some sort of independent monitor. Some of the stuff in that town, that city, included police officers who thought they had been fired upon, essentially chasing down a car and putting, I don't know, hundreds of bullets in the car, killing the couple in the car. No gun was discovered, and the police officers were white, and the people in the car were people of color. And by the way, as is almost always the case, nobody was charged. And by the way, that's the other thing which is intimately related to what we're talking about. One of the reasons you need a special prosecutor is because you need somebody to charge, not to blindly charge, not to say, oh, this shouldn't happen anymore, so I'm going to charge every single police officer who looks at me askance. But the case in New York, the Garner case, there was a videotape, no charges. Time and time again, police act in ways that many people think they ought not to, and nobody gets charged. So from the police officer's perspective, what incentive is there to behave any differently than they all behave now? There will be no consequences to whatever they do. And that's quite alarming that there's no accountability.
Well, James A. Cohen, professor of law at Fordham University in New York City, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask some questions about you. And one of them is, can you tell us about a eureka or an aha moment that changed your life or your view of the world?
I would say it's hard to pinpoint a moment, but I would say as I began to do criminal defense work, the power dynamic between different parts of our society became clearer and clearer and clearer, and is still clear today, I think. And that was sort of a eureka moment, and that moved me in the direction of, I think, then continuing and now continuing to represent people who don't have much power or any power at all.
That's what you've been doing. You've been doing it as a professor. And what I'd like to ask is, what would you like to do for the remainder of your one precious life?
Yes. Well, I'm actually moving in a somewhat different direction, because I found that the work that I've been doing for so long, representing people who did not have any power, takes an enormous toll on one. It is very, very stressful. So what I've moved into now, and we'll see how long I continue it, is doing what my colleagues do, which is more traditional class teaching. So I teach professional responsibility or legal ethics. I teach psychology in the criminal law, psychology in the civil law. And at least for this semester, as it comes to a crashing halt, I'm pretty happy doing that.
And finally, Jim Cohen, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Well, I've been doing some research on expert performance, and there is a compendium or an anthology written by or produced by a fellow named Anders Ericsson on expert performance, and he discusses a concept that he developed called deliberate practice, and it is not practice makes perfect. It's something called deliberate practice. And it is a guide, I think, to being more intentional about how one goes about exercising one's skill set. And it's very, very interesting. And it happens in all domains. So the sports domain is one that is pretty obvious. I'm not a big sports person, but it's pretty obvious. And, of course, sports teams are coached, and that's the deliberate part of the practice. But it happens in music. It happens in things that you wouldn't think of, like exercising judgment. You can become a better judgment exerciser by using this concept known as deliberate practice.
Well, Professor James A. Cohen from Fordham University in New York City, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure.
All of the evidence that was presented to the Ferguson, Missouri grand jury in the Michael Brown case that was released to the public, along with this entire interview recorded on December 5th, 2014, is available on the Radio Curious website. The books that Professor Cohen recommends are those written by Anders Ericsson, The Road to Excellence, The Acquisition of Expert Performance in the Arts, Sciences, Sports, and Games, and Development of Professional Expertise Toward Measurement of Expert Performance and Design of Optimal Learning Environments. There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org, where they're free for you to stream, download, enjoy, and share. We appreciate your curiosity, ideas, comments, and questions. You may reach us by email, curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnested is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.